There was this one girl I went to high school with where her mom was so into Farmville that she would take my friend out of school to go like harvest her raspberries and stuff because that had to happen every 4 hours. And just, it's a whole other level.
Visit Linode.com/StackOverflow and see why Linode has been voted the top infrastructure as a service provider by both G2 and Trust Radius. Linode makes cloud computing fast, simple, and affordable. Visit Linode.com/StackOverflow and you'll get $100 in credit. All right, head on over there, let them know the podcast sent you and support the show. Hello, everybody. This is Ben Popper. I haven't done this in a while. I guess I'm the director of content at Stack Overflow. Just getting back from 2 weeks of vacation. And I'm back to podcasting, the Stack Overflow podcast, which is all about software and technology, but mostly, hopefully, the art and practice of software development. I am joined today by three wonderful co-hosts. I will let them mostly introduce themselves. But today we have Sierra Ford, Ryan Donovan, and Cassidy Williams. Hello to the whole crew. Let's throw the hat around.
I like how you say you guessed that you were the director of content.
Lucky guess.
It's just like I always do that intro, but it's been two weeks.
I guess kind of like, this is who I am.
I always say something at the beginning. Yeah. Sometimes I just say director of content because I don't like to say marketing. Yeah, sure. So yeah.
Well, I guess I'm director of developer experience at Netlify, and I'm Cassidy. Hello.
I'm Ryan Donovan, and I reckon I'm editor of the blog at Stack Overflow.
Okay, this is a troll now.
This is super troll, yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Well, I'll jump in, and I'll end the trolling now because I'm new. So I'm just going to keep it to a regular introduction. I'm Ciora. A developer advocate at Apollo GraphQL. And as I said, I'm the newest addition to the podcast, and I'm really excited to be here with everyone today.
So great to have you here. Ciora, I was remembering the first time I ever met Cassidy and she came to New York and we did an episode. She extolled her love of Apollo GraphQL. So
yeah, that was my first blog post on Stack Overflow about Apollo GraphQL. Yeah.
So maybe we'll link that in the show notes. But I guess for folks who don't know, what is Apollo GraphQL? What is it used for? Where did it come from? And yeah, like in your work, what do you do through?
Yeah. Okay, cool. So Apollo GraphQL is basically a company that makes it easier for people to build GraphQL APIs. And eventually, each member of our developer advocacy team kind of has like a niche that they focus on. My niche is going to be basically backend developers or people who maintain APIs, GraphQL APIs, that kind of thing. So I'm hoping to ramp myself up to the level of proficiency with GraphQL where I'll be able to do that, which I'm happy about because I actually prefer backend development over front-end development, if I'm being completely honest. So I'm excited I get to like explore that, but with GraphQL APIs this time around. So, yeah.
Cool. So I've done a lot of REST API documentation and just heard about GraphQL. Can you tell me a little bit, like, what's the difference?
Yeah. So the main difference is, which I've been learning, it's funny that you say that because this is something I just learned recently. So the main difference with GraphQL, between GraphQL and REST APIs is that I guess GraphQL APIs are supposed to be more efficient than REST APIs in certain ways. And they're usually better for companies that have, or websites that have higher traffic, companies that are bigger, larger, because usually with REST APIs, when you're trying to retrieve data, you have to make multiple calls sometimes for something that's like in the same category is what I'll say. With one of the benefits of using GraphQL is that you don't have to do that. You can make one call to retrieve a bunch of data at one time.
What I like about GraphQL is it, and Apollo GraphQL specifically, is it really empowers me to get the data that I want in the format that I want. And so when I'm building some kind of application, and let's just say I want to build an avatar component or something, I can pull in just the data I need to build my avatar component or my user profile component. I don't need everything. Yeah. Whereas with REST, you might get everything. Yeah. So
you get the whole JSON block.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's another great point. Yeah.
You were describing it as like more modular and block and sort of a little bit just more flexible, right, Cassidy? Like you can get just the data you want, or then later, if you wanted to change the schema, you could do that easily.
Yeah, exactly. And so like if I wanted to extend my avatar to have the username or something, you can just add it in GraphQL and it just works.
Yeah. Another really cool thing about GraphQL too is that it kind of acts as the bridge between front end and back end, I think. Like a lot of front-end developers have experience with GraphQL, or opposed to, like, I don't know if too many front-end developers are super familiar with like REST APIs, because that's something most people will kind of like, we'll leave that to the back-end team to like build out and everything. But GraphQL kind of allows front-end developers to be more empowered in the whole process of like building applications, because it gives you more control over like what kind of data you can get and how to format it and all that kind of good stuff.
Right. It leads to really modular teams, because I can be like, I don't care if the back end is written in Rust and Go and Ruby and whatever. As long as I can get the data, that's what matters. And then with a GraphQL schema and interface I can pull from, I can just get what I need. And Apollo is really, really great at that.
And so is Apollo GraphQL, is that like a company that does one? Like, is one of these open and one of them private, or those two things always go together?
They're separate. So GraphQL is separate from Apollo GraphQL. Apollo is actually an open source company, but they're two separate things. So because I'm kind of like learning both together, I'm like, okay, which part of this is like Apollo and which part of this is actually GraphQL? Hopefully I'll become more clear on that over time. But
especially because like they make so much sense together.
Yeah.
And so using it without it, you'd be like, why would I use GraphQL alone? So I could see that's a learning you might come across.
Right.
You're taking notes here?
I mean, I think it's interesting. Like that is, I don't know too much about this specifically, but that's something that happens, right? Like people come to associate a certain set of more open source stuff with the company that does the best job or has, you know, like the best tooling for it or whatever. And then they kind of become interchangeable in people's minds.
Yeah. It also reminds me of when someone is like learning React, but they haven't really spent too much time learning JavaScript. So they like have a hard time telling like, which one is JavaScript, which one is React. That's what's kind of happening to me now. Sometimes I'm like, I don't know if I'm clear on what's the difference between the two right now. So
that's how I first learned it too. Cause I first learned GraphQL with Apollo. And then when I switched projects, switched companies and entered a whole new world where it was just GraphQL in the project I was using, I was like, oh no, did I actually learn something? And it was a bit of a relearning, but not too bad, because luckily they are pretty true to the language, but it's a thing.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
Well, Sarah, it's great to have you here. So for today, I'll kick us off with a topic that we had a little blog post on, which is we're all living in the metaverse. We just don't know it yet. Raise your hand on the call if you own an NFT or some crypto or have an avatar or a digital artifact. I guess that could be anything that you really care about, that you like sunk some money into.
Nope.
I guess.
Okay. Ryan's the only holder here.
I'm the old man of the group.
I probably have several thousand dollars worth of digital collectible cards that exist only in the digital universe. Magic cards and Hearthstone cards. I guess another thing that I was thinking about the metaverse is I have this screen name, SIENRAK, that I've been using since the AOL Instant Messenger days. And so I always try to get that one, and it's almost never taken. And so it's persistent. Like, it's like wherever I go, I have the same, even though it's like across many different parts of the internet.
It's an identity.
Exactly. So I feel like for me, for sure, there's like obviously things that I care about in the digital world that I collect that I think have, you know, value. And then for my kids, last year we're doing remote school, like Roblox was life. Like you would meet somebody one time and then you'd go remote and then you'd meet up in Roblox and you'd hang out there, but you'd be on a FaceTime, and like, it was probably more important to them, like what car you had in Roblox than like what car you showed up at school in. Like it didn't, you know, the clothes you have in Roblox are way more important than like the clothes you wear to school. So for them, it's definitely just like, part of growing up is like thinking about that's natural to them. But to throw it out to all of you, like what has been your interaction with kind of this burgeoning world of NFTs and metaverse talk, and what do you make of it?
You're talking about Roblox reminds me of Neopets back in the day. Paint your pet.
People are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for digital rocks, which made me think of pet rocks. Whoa. We'll see which one retains its value for longer.
That just made me think of in between like Neopets and like the Roblox. On DS, there was this one game where you had a pet dog that would like wait for you and wait for you to feed it. I can't even
Nintendogs?
Remember. Nintendogs.
That's a really good name.
And I used to like rush home, like, let me feed my dog to make sure he's like still alive and everything. Like,
It's like the old Tamagotchi. Yeah.
Tamagotchi was the OG of that, right?
It reminds me of Farmville too, because I remember there was this one girl I went to high school with where her mom was so into Farmville that she would take my friend out of school to go like harvest her raspberries and stuff, because that had to happen every 4 hours.
Oh my God.
And just, it's a whole other level.
So yeah, I feel like when it comes to right, like people valuing digital objects and being, you know, as invested in their digital life, like The Sims or whatever as their real life, to people of maybe our age cohort, that seems totally natural. Spending, you know, what seems to me like a fortune. I know for people who are like early in crypto, that's the thing. It doesn't feel like if you have 1,000 ETH, then paying five of them doesn't feel like a big deal, even though in the real world, it's a ton of money. But I guess, you know, yeah, the thing is like Farmville, everything lives in Farmville, you know, Tamagotchi. With the NFTs, it's supposed to be, you own it, even though it can get out into the digital universe. I emotionally, personally can't get over that like hill. It's like, I would never pay this much money for a bunch of pixels that anybody could copy, but that's just
the
me.
Part of it for me that's like, because yeah. People can still use it. So it's not like you have like the right, well, I don't understand how like you own the rights to this image if people can freely still use, or this GIF, people can freely still use it. That just to me is like, I don't know if I can really process that too well in my brain. Right.
They can screenshot it.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Well, you can resell it. Yeah. Then. It makes it a resaleable object.
Right. Well, and what was interesting too to see was I saw this whole article where this person got an NFT and wanted to print a poster of it because they really liked this NFT that they bought. And the original artist was like, no, you can't do that. You don't have permission. And they're right. Like, I bought this thing for like $5,000 and I can't man. Make a poster. Should've read the terms for my of service. Home.
Yeah. No, yeah. Sorry. Check the TLS. Yeah.
And they're just like, no, you only own the digital version. You don't, right. You can't do this. And that part really, I was starting to try to get on board with my understanding, but that just totally put me back to square zero.
Yeah.
I
wanted to kind of touch back on something you said, Ben. You're going back and using screen names. Is that still a thing that people do? Have this kind of invented screen name?
Yes.
That's a good question.
Me, I do.
Because I think that in the early internet days, like the internet was an entirely separate thing, right? You had this mediated secret name, and that's how you existed. You didn't exist as yourself. Right. And I think now the internet is more yourself on there. So of course you're buying, you know, pieces of virtual real estate.
I think it depends on the community you talk to.
Yeah.
I'm in a part of like many Discord channels, for example, where yes, there's some people where you're just like, oh yeah, I recognize your username from various places, but there's some people who are anonymous on purpose. And they don't need people to know what they look like, who their face is. They're perfectly nice people. We chat with them regularly, but
yeah.
You don't know anything about them.
I do think, social media, like from the Facebook age onward, a lot of people just were their public selves, like on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, you're just the same person you are in real life. And you're even like building up your following there, what would be the point of doing it anonymously? Like that's kind of counterintuitive.
Well, and that was the novelty then, because it was just like, oh, we used to be all anonymous. Now we're real. And now I think maybe it'll swing back in the other direction.
Yeah.
Actually, I think you're right. I could see it swinging back in the other direction, because I think a lot of people now are seeing like the drawbacks of being super present online and putting yourself out there a lot online.
Right.
Sometimes you can run into like a lot of harassment, like tons of different things. Yeah. So I
get swatted.
Yeah. I even now can like see the appeal of being totally anonymous online.
Yeah.
Like I get why that would be appealing for some people.
I know we have a couple of community managers here that don't use their real names.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not saying that I do this, but I do think that, I'm not saying I don't do this, but I do think that they're like, I'm very on Twitter. I think mostly because like as a journalist, once upon a time, that was like necessary for the job. And that's kind of like, as your Twitter followers grew, it was like some status symbol of your career or whatever. But there's a lot of accounts that I follow on there in media and finance and technology where, to be brutally honest and to like call out what you see and to take aim at people who are powerful, if you create a pseudonym and it has a personality, you can just say exactly what's on your mind, you know? And those accounts become very popular because they're just like speaking truth to power. Whereas if you're like yourself and you have a career, or you know, you have peers, you have alliances, you have whatever, like you can't be that blunt, you know, you can't be that truthful. Yeah,
because people will hold you accountable.
I've often thought, and you'll make like enemies. It'd be kind of fun to make some kind of alt account just so I can actually speak my mind on some subjects, because there's sometimes where like I want to call out this person for harassing people or something like that, but I don't want to be on their target list next and that sort of thing. And so it's tempting. Did you all see that Yik Yak is back? Speaking of anonymity.
Yik Yak.
What is Yik Yak? I feel like I heard this, but I'm very confused.
It's like Twitter, but it's more like Reddit, I guess.
Okay.
It's fully anonymous. You make a little post, people can upvote it and people can comment on it, but you don't have a username or anything. You can just post anonymously.
So like 4chan?
Then? Yeah. And so that's the thing. Yik Yak existed in like 2013 to 2015-ish.
Yeah.
And then they took it down because of a ton of harassment and stuff.
Okay.
You're remembering it.
I think I remember this because like I know there was a thing where people were using it in like school.
Yeah,
it was big on college campuses.
Yes, huge in college campuses.
People would say like, "Oh, like I did such and such with so and so," and like really put their name out there. But like no one, or like I have a crush on so and so, and nobody would know who it was because your name is not tied to it. I'm remembering. Okay,
yeah, and it was super local and stuff.
Yeah.
And so it just came back like last week or 2 weeks ago. The Yak is back, and it's been interesting. I have it, and it's not the same as it was in college, just because I live in a big city, and so my local radius covers probably 100,000 people. But it is kind of nice to just like have that anonymous thing, even if it's just to like troll people. Sometimes I'll just like make a poop joke or something that I wouldn't normally tweet. And it's very fun to just kind of put it out there and be just like, okay.
It's a good place to test the jokes. You know, you just put it out and see how it does.
Yeah, exactly.
The only thing is, I don't think most people are going to use it that way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it is not used that way.
The tweets here are like, guys, buckle up. Yeah.
I am one of very few. But anyway, they shut it down for harassment. And now they have a lot more rules. Like they have a no real name policy. So you couldn't say who you had a crush on or anything. You can't say these names. And they have basically lots and lots of reporting mechanisms now where if something is inappropriate, it's shut down.
The tweets that I'm seeing here embedded on the news story is, buckle up. There's a chance Yik Yak is back. If you were there at its prime, you know the chaos that this app wrought. Yeah. And you know, people, we're doing bomb threats and then they have to shut the college down and it just became, it's like the human instinct to like pay attention to gossip and drama is so strong. And then if you combine that with like the viral mechanics of social media and total anonymity, it's like, it's a recipe for disaster.
Oh, right. Yeah.
What's been interesting in my little area of Chicago is it's really just a lot of people organizing saying, you know, the red line really needs reform. Does anybody want to host a community meeting and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Sometimes I do think social media would be better if, like on Stack Overflow, let's say you run Yik Yak, like your first couple of posts didn't really, they could only get like the minimum of organic engagement. And then after like 3 months, if everything you posted was like, didn't violate any rules, then you'd get a little bit more of like the algorithm juice. So like if you're a responsible user over time, you like build up, you know, whatever.
You get the tutorial level.
Yeah, exactly. And you have certain permissions and not others. And I feel it's the same way about misinformation. Like it's so easy to spin up an anti-vax account and very quickly get huge, which is like, you know, you could be anybody. You could be a troll or a bot or a nation state, but it's like, well, what you'd have to like earn the audience, like go 6 months or a year with no, you know, flagrant violations. And then, you know, you might start to get some reach or whatever.
Mm.
Right.
I'm going to fix the internet.
I've never even heard of that model before. That's interesting.
I think Ben just made it up.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, like the downside then is that like that favors, you know, the old guard. And so, you know, what we deal with a lot on Stack Overflow is like, how do we bring new people in? And people who answered questions in 2009 have millions of points worth of reputation now. They could downvote as forever because like just over time their reputation keeps stacking. So the question is then how to balance that out and not let like, you know, the old guard have too much power, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of like how I have a Wikipedia account from like high school. And it was purely because I wanted to like edit a super small thing. But because I have an old edit that's like still on the website from some like 2008.
Yeah.
Or something. I have like a credible Wikipedia account. I only have those two edits, but I'm like able to make pages and stuff because of those permissions.
What were your high school edits? What did you need to fix?
I edited a summary of a book I read and then I fixed a quote for like DNA replication or something. It was when I was in biology class way back.
Wow. That makes me think about all the times when I was like a teenager and like in my little fangirl phase and I wanted to like edit some fact about Harry Styles, like, this is incorrect. Yeah. Technically, this is what happened. Yeah. And I just never did. I probably should have. I would have been like,
you could have had this reputation.
Yeah.
I have some points on Genius for trying to interpret rap lyrics at one point in my life, I think.
Really?
Yeah. This is what I'm pretty sure this is what Lil Wayne really meant. It's like, I have no idea.
I think I have some posts on everything too. Yeah. Way back in the day.
Man. All right. We've been talking about, digital pixels being worth a lot of money. You pay like $1 a pixel for these NFTs at least. What do we know about file formats? Cassidy, you wanted to talk to us a little bit about a cool one that allows you to really compress things, save a lot of data, load your stuff faster. Everybody always loves that.
Yeah. And so there's this file format it's around a year old now, AVIF, A-V-I-F. Mm-hmm. And it's an image format that's like slowly growing around the internet, and browser support is starting to get better on it. And if you look at the Stack Overflow newsletter, there's an article that goes into this in much more depth. But you can have a high resolution image, something that is super comparable to your average JPEG or PNG, but it's super small. Like, I think the comparison I saw was if the JPEG is 80 kilobytes or whatever, the AVIF is 16. And wow. And so it's quite the difference, and it could make for really, really performant sites and everything once it gets more popular in browsers.
Do you have any idea how it does that?
Algorithms?
I don't know how it works, but there is a big post up on the Netflix tech blog, which is typically really good, talking about AVIF for next generation image coding. So I'll link that if you want to dive a little deeper. It seems like they explain it and why they like it. Oh, along with a brief history of image coding formats.
Oh.
But is this related to the AVI, like the old music and video format, or no?
I think that's where the name comes from.
I think the little I read, it says it takes frames from AV1 files.
AV1 just makes me think of like back in the day when I could right click on a video on the internet and download it. And then I would just like rip all these videos and keep them for later. No? Nobody? Okay. Speaking of images, Sierra, you wanted to chat a little bit about super resolution. Was that yours or no?
I actually came across this on Twitter about like Google doing something with AI and image resolution, which is, I think, a conversation we see happen every like couple months about like how to, you know, clear up the pixels in a blurry photo to like make the resolution better or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because on Twitter, people were having a conversation again about how like a lot of times this technology doesn't work out as well as we think it should. Right. And I think like we just talked about earlier how a lot of times, you know, we might create something with good intentions, like Yik Yak, and then people totally misuse it or it doesn't turn out the way we want it to. And I think that's something a lot of people anticipate with like these image resolution technologies that like do it by machine learning.
Right.
I think there's like one popular image of like a blurred image of Obama who has like tons of images online. So there's tons for like machine learning technologies or whatever to like
data sets and stuff.
Right. Yeah. But even still, the image, when it was resoluted, when it was like corrected, it pulls up a picture of a white guy with blue eyes. So, and that's Obama. So, you know, people always refer to that as like, this is maybe not something that will turn out so well, but Google is saying that like this time around, it's going to be better than it normally is. So yeah.
This time around.
Well, we've heard that before.
Yeah.
The post we had with Intel was doing it, machine learning on just a single image to kind of up resolution it. And it was pretty good. You know, it got this text on a flag that was in a tiny, tiny corner.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, you're right. If you're using, you know, a huge corpus of data that is Obama,
right?
Maybe they only got the half of it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
It's like, not Obama, but yeah.
This is why we need diversity in AI.
Yeah.
Because if we keep having the same people training these data sets, people are going to start looking the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a famous data set that is notoriously racially biased that a lot of image AI.
The old ImageNet data set or whatever, the one that everybody used for a long time.
Yeah. Where, you know, people of color can't unlock their phones because of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had this discussion with the guy who was kind of behind the super resolution demo. He built it for Intel. And he was like a very galaxy brain kind of guy. He was like, you know, sometimes I just sit around and I'm thinking like, people are seeing this photo. It's so good, but it's not real. because like the computer made it. So it's like what the computer made is better than what was really there. And it's like, what is real? Right? We're like, yeah, man. Like this isn't our usual sponsored blog content, but sure. Like let's talk. But yeah, no, I do think that's interesting. Cause like the amount of like artificiality, you know, that goes into a photo is like, you know, you could go down a rabbit hole with that debate and never end. Like a photograph is not real. You know, the colors of a 70s or 80s photograph don't look the same as now, but it is interesting when you get to the point where like it's replacing a lot of pixel or clarity or even like substance in an image that wasn't there. It's guessing at what you saw.
Right. Yeah. This just made me think of too, like how with like photo editing apps and like even stuff like Snapchat where you can have filters and stuff like that, like we don't really look that way. And like some people will edit their faces to look like unrecognizable to make themselves look younger, taller, whatever, which is it's just a strange part of like living on the internet. I'm even thinking about like Zoom has a lot of like filters and things like that where you can clear up your image and make your skin look better.
Update my appearance.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, if I meet my coworkers in person for the first time, are they going to be like, what? Like, this is how you actually look. So yeah, it's like, it gets really meta when you start thinking about like images and pictures and videos and how we present ourselves online and like versus how we present ourselves in person and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I keep it real straight edge. Like what you see is what you get. There's no filter. I'm not filtering anything here.
Hashtag no filter.
I mean, if you really want to go like bonkers on it, you know, any camera lens distorts an image.
Right.
And I read some stuff that our brains are not designed to accurately perceive reality. They're just to do it in a way that helps us survive. Right. So what is
there is no past or future. There's only now. Cause like what I'm understanding now actually happened 6 seconds ago and I just had to process it. Right.
My brain is doing backflips right now.
Right now. Right now.
All right, y'all, let's wrap up. I wanted to shout out a great question that I saw on the Hot Network questions. It was from the Cybersecurity Stack Exchange. And the question was, can I sample celestial bodies for my randomness in cryptography? Meaning like I need a source of like random data that will, a truly random data. And I guess the answer is yes. You can gaze up at the stars and gather some random feedback that will make your crypto pretty secure. I thought that was a great question. I'll throw it in the show notes. If you want to catch up with any of us after the show, you can always email us podcast@StackOverflow with questions or suggestions. If you like the show, please do leave a rating and review. I am Ben Popper. I'm pretty sure I'm the director of content marketing here at Stack Overflow. And you can always find me on Twitter at Ben Popper.
I'm Ryan Donovan. I'm a content marketer here at Stack Overflow. I am a ghost on Twitter at rthordonovan. And if you have a great idea for a blog for the Stack Overflow blog, you can email me at pitches@stackoverflow.com.
I'm Cassidy Williams, Director of Developer Experience at Netlify. You can find me at Cassidoo, C-A-S-S-I-D-O-O, most places on the internet. And feel free to send me a joke sometime.
And I'm Ciora. I'm Developer Advocate at Apollo GraphQL. And you can find me mostly on Twitter. I spend way too much time there at Ciorio _. That's CEEOREO _.
Very cool. All right. I think our mission for the next 6 months is to get Ryan to start using Twitter.
Yeah.
You can't. You got to start using it.
Only if I could monetize it.
Just when you have a joke you want to test out, you just try it. Oh, yeah. Give them all your super follows. Definitely.
There you go.
There you go.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening.